Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Once upon a time, early humans worried about two things. Those two things were pretty much the same across the mammalian world: getting enough to eat and being eaten by another species. Today, we're worried about getting a job, keeping a job, retirement, paying the bills, finding a relationship, holding on to a good relationship, building a family, getting the kids into a good school, kids getting a job after the good school, kids paying the bill for a good school. Well, then the list goes on and on. Well, my guest today says our neural stress systems are really developed for those simple stressors of early man and ill-equipped to handle the day-to-day stresses of contemporary life. Neuroscientist, biologist, and science writer Robert Sapolsky is considered one of the top specialists on stress's effect on humans and has contributed groundbreaking research on primates and how their stress mirrors our own. Sapolsky is a professor of biology, neuroscience, and neurosurgery at Stanford University, a MacArthur Genius Fellow, as well as a research scientist at the Institute of Primate Research at the National Museum of Kenya. For over 30 years, he's studied baboon groups, who, like humans, live in complex social groups where stress is high. And he found that, like humans, baboons also suffer from high cholesterol and high blood pressure. Robert Sapolsky, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Glad to be here.
You're best known for your work in stress, but probably some people might not know that you really have spent over 30 years studying baboons, and really it was for their reactions to stress. So what's been the attraction of this particular species, and what about their study tells us about ourselves regarding stress and human behavior?
Basically, baboons are perfect for what I've been interested in because they're totally rotten, miserable, aggressive, scheming creeps, which is very good for understanding human stress. If you try to understand why humans are so prone towards stress-related disease, kind of the punchline of the whole field is we don't get stressed like normal animals do. We don't get stressed because somebody's very intent on predating us or because we're about to starve if we don't chase down a zebra. We've got this great luxury where we can sit around and invent psychological stress for ourselves, chronic psychological stress, and that's not what the system evolved for. The whole stress response system evolved basically to deal with 3 minutes of running for your life across the savanna. And if instead you turn it on chronically because of this psychological nonsense, you're going to get sick. Now, baboons are ideal for thinking about this stuff because they're not like most mammals out there. They've got a pretty good lifestyle. The guys that I study live in the Serengeti, a national park system in East Africa, and if you're a baboon and you get a choice in the matter, this is where you want to live. You live in these big organized troops, so the predators don't hassle you much. Your kids have a pretty good chance of surviving. Most importantly, in this great ecosystem, you only have to spend about 3 hours a day foraging for your food. And what that means is you could spend 9 hours of free time every day to just making some other baboon miserable. They're all about social and psychological stress. If you're a baboon and you're ulcerating, it's not because the lions are hassling you every morning. It's because another member of your own species is psychologically stressing you. They're just like us westernized humans.
How will they manifest the stress as it shows up in the social order? Do they just tend to be aggressive with one another, or?
Well, it depends who you are and often what mood you're in. I mean, it could range from the big dramatic dominance hierarchy, punch-it-out fights. Male baboons have humongous sharp canines. They use them. Male baboons are pretty much the leading cause of death of male baboons. In terms of injuries that go septic, things like that. So, you get the big drama of that, but it's mostly not that. Instead, it's mostly just pushing somebody's nose and their subordinates. There's like some great little patch of grass roots or something to pull out of the ground to eat whatever it is these guys eat. And some low-ranking schnook is sitting there pulling out his breakfast, and you're some high-ranking guy, and just because you could do it, you go over to him and you boot him out of that spot. And he goes and he walks 20 feet and he sits down in a new patch of grass and you go do it to him again and you do it again. You just do it a half dozen times. There's a million blades of grass in every direction that you look. But no, you want whichever one he's sitting down in front of, and it's just sheer harassment. This is a very familiar scenario. Even among baboons, stuff rolls down the dominance hierarchies.
Now, is there empathy within baboons that another at this subordinate level will kind of say, oh, that's okay, or are they not so much made up that way?
Well, this whole issue of empathy is a hugely hot topic among various types of scientists, recognizing the fact we're not the only species that shows the building blocks of that. Chimps, some poor chimp gets savaged from some higher-ranking jerk who's in a bad mood, and that poor, innocent bystander chimp over the next half hour or so is much more likely than usual to have other animals come by and groom him. They understand he's having a hard day and didn't ask for it, and there's something resembling empathy going on there. Rodents have even been shown to have sort of the starts of empathy. Baboons could do it, but it depends who you are. Relatives will be very empathic to each other's problems. My jaded interpretation is occasionally a male will pretend to be empathic with a female who he's interested in passing on copies of his genes with, but it usually looks pretty unconvincing. But individuals there can be quite empathic, can be quite altruistic, self-sacrificial, all of that, but it helps if it's for a relative or someone you've known your whole life and have some sort of stable, cooperative relationships with. Your average off-the-street baboon is not going to do random acts of kindness.
And in fact, in the course of your research, what poses as the dominant alpha male behavior has really changed. He is the dominant alpha male, but as far as what he does for the troop, it's changed. I was recalling a line in one of your books in which he said, you know, that we thought of the dominant alpha male as being the one that would fend off all invaders, but really he's only going to fend off the one that's threatening his own offspring. If it's not a close relative, he's up in the top of the tree.
Absolutely, and using his dominance just to get the best of you. This has been sort of a shift in primatology, anthropology. Baboons have sort of been one of the favorite species for people in my business to study for decades, and they used to be the textbook example of what a society looks like that is male-dominated, stratified, hierarchy-driven, highly aggressive, all of that. And what you wind up coming away with an impression of from sort of those early studies was that alpha male baboons, that male baboons run the show, that they know what's going on, that the alpha male is the one who, as you said, in that great sort of heartwarming scenario, out pops the lion, and the alpha male is in the front defending all and, you know, changing the light bulbs afterward. And in reality, that's not the case at all. The structure in baboon society in these open grassland savannas, the structure is that male baboons leave their home troop around puberty. They pick up and they migrate half a mile or 50 miles, they find some other troop, and they go through adulthood there, slowly working their way up in the hierarchy. In contrast, females spend their whole life in the same troop. Their whole life with their female relatives, their whole life knowing everybody there. Males, an alpha male is someone who showed up with a lot of attitude as some pimply teenager a couple of years earlier, and it's the females who are sort of the core of the troop. The females decide where the progressions are in the morning. The females are the ones who remember which grove of trees they went to umpteen years ago, the last time there was a drought, that kind of thing. The males make a lot of noise, but they're not central to the troop at all, and they certainly don't have any kind of semblance of civic duty. And one of the best examples of that is you get some high-ranking guy who gets dumped in the hierarchy because some young Turk is on his way up and has put on a couple more pounds of muscle. And this guy has just been dumped, does not go quietly into the night. He switches troops. he goes and tries another company to work for and see how his luck fares in that one. They don't have a whole lot of connectiveness to their particular troop. They're just there with a certain sort of realpolitik attitude. The females are the core of the troops.
That sounds amazingly human in many senses.
Yes, it does.
Well, so getting back to stress, is it something about this particular troop of baboons, because they're in the national park, that they have all this somewhat idle time to torment each other and to cause that sort of day-to-day stress? Or is it something about baboons in general?
Well, I think it's baboons and anything resembling a reasonable habitat for them. Mm-hmm. This is what you would see. And one of the things I wind up doing out there is these guys are habituated enough to me and sort of my field assistants that I can dart them. I use an anesthetic blowgun and anesthetize these guys. And what I then do are basically the same sort of clinical tests that are done on humans. I can take blood samples. The last season I was out there, I had a portable EKG machine for seeing how their hearts were doing, you know, and just looking at how their bodies are working and who's getting the, you know, high blood pressure, who's gotten the rotten cholesterol levels, things of that sort, and what does it have to do with your social rank, your personality, your patterns of social affiliation. And what's that tell us about us?
Now, at first glance, I would think that if baboons have lived this way for millennia, then they would be pretty well adapted to that stress, and they wouldn't have a whole lot of stress-related illnesses. Is that the case?
Well, once again, it depends on who you are. And getting us into the same sort of issues as when dealing with humans, the fact that, you know, most of us are navigating relatively similar worlds. I mean, we all live in a world where, like, we have agriculture, we make tools, we usually get freaked out during traffic jams, things of that sort, and where there's tremendous individual differences as to who's collapsing into puddles of stress-related disease and who copes well. You see very similar variability among the baboons.
And so the higher you are in the hierarchy, the better you're dealing with stress in general?
That's what I went out when I was 20 and started this, being convinced I was going to see. And I proceeded to waste, I don't know, about the next 20 years of my life, thinking that the most interesting thing was going to be was your rank. Rank is destiny. And what I was sure I was going to see was that if you're a high-ranking baboon, you're going to be less prone towards stress-related diseases, you're going to have lower blood pressure, all sorts of stuff like that, because you in that high-ranking position have all these great psychological advantages of dominance. You've got social control and predictability, and if you're in a foul, stressed mood, you could take it out on somebody smaller. And at a first glance, at first 20 years worth of glances, that seems to be what's going on. It's when you start looking more closely that you see that there's much, much more interesting things going on. Rank has something to do with it, has a lot to do with it, but much more important is what the rank means. What's the social context for the rank? And as such, what you see is in a nice, stable dominance hierarchy, being at the top of the heap is great for your health. You've got the least stress, all those psychological advantages. On the other hand, if the hierarchy is unstable, if you're in the middle of a revolution and ranks are shifting all over the place and huge numbers of fights, and the guy sitting on top of this sort of cyclone, he's got the worst health at the time. It's not being high-ranking, it's whether high-rank is bringing lots of psychological advantages or whether it means, you know, you're in the palace while the peasants are rioting at the gates. So it depends on the social context for the rank. And that's exactly what you see. And then the hierarchy stabilizes, whatever it is that's going on gets worked out, and you come back 6 months later, and being in the alpha position is this great healthy spot to be. It really depends on the context.
My guest today is Professor Robert Sapolsky, the John and Cynthia Gunn Professor of Biology, Neurology, and Neuroscience at Stanford University. He's the author of Why Zebras Don't Get Ulcers, A Primate's Memoir, Monkey Love, and Other Essays on Our Lives as Animals, just a few of his books. And he's best known for his work on stress. And one of the things that you've related is how human worry has changed spectacularly over the past 100 years. You know, the reason zebras don't get ulcers is because it's a flight or fight situation. It's over quickly. Humans, we used to have that at one point in our life, but now we don't worry about being the next meal or finding our next meal and disease and sickness so much as worrying about everything from traffic to whether we're going to get the next promotion. Is Social Security going to be there for us? And we are spectacularly, we don't adapt well to that sort of stress, do we?
No, because it really has evolved in an evolutionary eye blink. And when you look at the hormones we secrete during stress, adrenaline, epinephrine is the most famous one, but there's another class of them called glucocorticoids, corticosteroids. The human one is hydrocortisone. When you look at these hormones and what the body does during stress, you see the exact same stress response, the same hormones being secreted by fish, by birds, by reptiles. I mean, this is ancient wiring in animal systems. And when we go and turn it on because we're watching a scary movie, we're watching a bunch of pixels on a screen that we could interpret as something terrifying that in reality has absolutely nothing to do with us. When we can do this, is very recent evolution. And even if you have a baboon who is smart enough to sit there and see his rival on the other side of the field and feel vaguely disquieted, that kind of psychological stress, even in these other species, this is really recent stuff. I mean, we're talking hundreds of millions of years of organisms turning on the stress response because something's really intent on eating them. I mean, the ability of really psychosocially smart primates like us and these other few species to sit there and just do it with thoughts and emotions and memory, this is really, really new use of a very ancient system. And we just haven't evolved a very good sort of circuitry yet so that our brains and our bodies can very reliably say, this is a lion versus this is worries about Social Security.
Yeah. And what happens to those chemicals? I would think that in a flight or fight situation, they go to the body, you have this burst of adrenaline, this, you know, you have this incredible physical exertion. I'm thinking it spends those chemicals.
That's exactly what happens. You know, one of the first things that adrenaline does is it gets energy from storage sites in your body, your fat cell, your liver. It takes stored energy and just dumps it in the direction of your exercising muscles. And this is exactly what you want to be doing if somebody's intent on predating you. You increase your blood pressure, your heart rate. You turn off all sorts of unessential processes in the body. You know, you're running for your life. This is not quite the day to, you know, work on hitting puberty or something. Do it some other time. You shut down all sorts of long-term building projects. You just focus on, and this makes perfect sense if what stress is about is just a couple of minutes of a crisis that demands some physical exertion. And it's a brilliantly evolved system, and it's exactly these sorts of effects that will save your neck, whether you're a fish or you're a giraffe or everything in between, makes perfect sense. And where we then get into trouble, exactly as you say, is that we turn on the exact same stress response for psychological reasons. You're sitting there worrying about your 30-year mortgage, and your body is doing stuff designed to make your thigh muscles work better over the next 30 seconds, and this really is not a very good match between what your body needs and what it winds up doing.
And we have a pretty good understanding of what happens when all those chemicals flood the body and they're not actually used. They basically turn on the body, don't they?
Yep, it's wear and tear, and increase your blood pressure through the roof because you're sprinting away from a lion, and this is a very good thing to do. Do the exact same thing because you're worrying about, you know, only 8 more months until taxes or who knows what, and do that chronically, and you're not like running away from a predator. You're suffering from stress-induced high blood pressure. If you turn off repair processes in your body, for example, most of our stomachs are pretty good at repairing the starts of an ulcer. And, oh no, don't bother doing that now because you're running away from a lion. That makes wonderful sense. Oh no, don't bother doing it today. Do it tomorrow, do it tomorrow, do it tomorrow, because you're constantly psychologically stressed, and you're more at risk for the bacteria that cause ulcers to get away with it. If you're constantly on this sort of crisis emergency economy in your body for nonsense psychological reasons, you never fix. You never, just everything is running on sort of just a piece of duct tape. And that's where stress-related disease comes from. That's why we get far more of it than other species.
And we know that it attacks various parts of the brain as well?
Yeah, probably the most disturbing part of the story. And this is what I've divided my life between the baboon work in Africa and running a neurobiology lab. And this is what my lab is focused on over the years, and work with rats and cultured neurons, basically looking at the fact that all sorts of parts of the brain don't work as well when you are chronically stressed. The example we all know is that your memory is lousy during periods of severe stress. You have trouble sleeping, your judgment goes out the window, you're more prone towards anxiety, you're more prone towards depression. And people understand tons about how this stuff works, and there's increasing evidence to suggest even that basically the rates at which our brains age are very sensitive to how much stress we've had over the years.
My guest today is Robert Sapolsky. He's the author of Why Zebras Don't Get Ulcers, a primate's memoir. He's split time between studying baboons and humans in neurology and neuroscience, and he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Well, one of the things you've said about these stress-related illnesses like heart disease, high blood pressure, high cholesterol, and all the things that, diabetes, how much of this is stress-related? How much of this is diet-related? Or does the diet part have to do with the stress in your mind?
Perfect. Total intertwining of the two. It's rare that stress actually causes a disease. What stress does is make you more vulnerable to other causes of disease. It makes you less likely to repair the consequences of other causes of diseases. And, the interaction between stress and diet is a perfect example of this. For example, some wonderful work done by a group out in North Carolina with captive primates looking at the relationship between social rank, and these were among female macaque monkeys, between social rank and aspects of atherosclerosis. And what you saw was a general picture between if you were in a subordinate being dumped on position in your monkey society, you were more prone towards atherosclerosis, hardening, clogging of the arteries. But what they showed was if you couple low social rank with a high fat diet, the effect absolutely goes through the roof. In other words, some synergistic whammy going on there between dietary risk factors for health and psychosocial risk factors. Now, where you really get into trouble is it's not just the case that some of the bad effects of stress can amplify some of the bad effects of diet. When we're stressed, we tend to eat in a way that's less ideal for our health. I mean, if you want to solve half the cases of diabetes in this country, what you need to do is figure out why is it that when we feel like nobody loves us, we eat starch.
That's true.
How did that wind up being a central issue in making sense of public health? but that's absolutely the case. And there's been totally clear, like nuts and bolts, real science, biology stuff showing what goes on in the brain that when an organism is stressed, that carbohydrates taste better and lower your stress hormone levels. So you've got this loop there. Not only is there interaction between stress and health risk factors like diet, when we're under stress, our diets get worse. We sleep less. We do all sorts of imprudent things, and that just sort of exacerbates the problem in lots of cases.
Earlier we were talking about how stability affects primate stress levels. Is it the same in humans? If you have a stable professional life, a stable home life, stable interactions with family and friends, are you likely to see lower stress levels? Or are there also humans that seem to thrive under that constant stress? You always hear of these stories of people who seem to thrive under lots and lots of professional stress, home personal stress.
Great. Well, two different questions there. The first one is, how much does something like control and predictability help in terms of managing stress? And the answer is a huge amount. Tiny example of it, sort of experimental example. Take somebody, some college freshman who's volunteered for this, and sit him in a room, and every now and then unpredictably like blast him for a second with like 120 decibels, and what do you know, their blood pressure goes up. Instead, if 10 seconds before each blast, a little warning light comes on, blood pressure doesn't go up anywhere as much. You've given them predictive information. You've let them know when is it coming, how bad is it going to be, how long is it going to last. I mean, that's exactly what we do when we ask the dentist, are you almost done drilling? So that is a very small example. On a huge level of it, what studies have shown is when you look at, for example, how health declines in populations during periods of economic downturn, lots of people losing their jobs, all of that, you don't see say the shifts in blood pressure most dramatically at the time that people are getting laid off. You see it earlier when the first hints start arising that there's going to be layoffs. When the unpredictability begins to filter in there, that's the really corrosive stuff. So issues like control and predictability are hugely important in making sense of coping with psychological stress.
The second question. Are there people really out there who can handle this sort of constant level of stress?
Well, we all know our adrenaline junkies, and we all know how there's people in circumstances who absolutely love what they're doing, while the rest of us would like fling ourselves out a window if we had to do that, and these huge individual differences. And there's the subset of people who thrive on what everybody else would see as a hugely stressful life. And that could be hugely stressful, you know, running a massive company, or hugely stressful being an air traffic controller, or you know, Navy SEAL, or whatever version of it. And we say, oh my God, what's up with these people who could deal with constant stress? And I think one of the clues there to making sense of it as to why people like that are not falling apart is, in reality, it's not constant stress. We will say, oh my God, I am stressed just 24/7. You want to know what 24/7 stress looks like? That's somebody with like 90% of their body burned, or like someone in sepsis or something. When we say, oh my God, just I'm constantly stressed, what it means is, in actuality, there's a lot of sort of discrete bursts of stress throughout the day, and then lots of periods of recovery in between. And I think where you really see the individual differences coming in is in recovery time. When you look at individuals, whether a lab rat up to a human, where there's big differences in ability to cope with stress, it's not so much that they differ as to how fast they could turn on a stress response when something awful happens. Where the meaningful differences come in is how fast do they recover. And a tendency of people who are viewed as very good at dealing with major stressors is they've got a fast on and a fast off. They've got a rapid recovery.
Robert Sapolsky, it's been a pleasure to talk with you. Thanks so much for joining us.
Well, thanks. Likewise.
Dr. Robert Sapolsky is a professor of biology and neurology at Stanford University and the author of Why Zebras Don't Get Ulcers, among other titles. He was the University of Tulsa presidential lecturer back in April. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.